This is episode 13 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pysh and Stig Broderson.
All right. Good morning, everybody. This is Preston Pysh, and I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson. And we've brought Hari Ramachandra back on the show because we are talking about something very interesting today, Google. For everybody out there, I'm sure they've used Google with their search results, but picking apart and understanding what it is that makes Google tick is something that very few people understand. So today in our show, we're going to be talking about a book that all three of us have read, and the name of the book is In the Plex. This is a best-selling book, and this is by Stephen Levy, and the subtitle of the book is that it talks about what Google thinks, works, and shapes our lives. And so that's what we're going to be discussing today as we kind of go through the essence of this book. So for today's show, we are going to break this down into two different segments. The first segment, we're going to discuss the book, and we're going to be really discussing what it is that makes Google tick. At the end of the show, we'll move into the second segment, and we're going to be talking about our thoughts on why or why not we would own stock in Google. So we'll go around the horn and get everybody's opinion. So let's go ahead and kick this off. We'll start off with the very first point when this book opens up. And I found it just absolutely fascinating the way that this book starts, because the author talks about what it is that Sergey Brin and Larry Page, who are the two founders of Google, what their overall mission and goal is for Google. And that mission is that they want Google to be the brain of the world. And I think for a lot of people, they hear that and they're like, okay, so what in the world does that mean? And it means exactly what I said, is they are trying to take Google to be the hub or the brain of every thought that's ever been captured in the world, that's been captured on the internet, and harnessing that and providing that to people. So if you ever have any question whatsoever, that question can be immediately answered with your smartphone or your computer by just typing in whatever your question is. That's their goal. They want there to be no boundaries between language. So if you type something in and you want to know what that means in Korean or Russian or any language, you will get the answer no matter what. So that's a pretty lofty goal. That's something that I think a lot of people might think, wow, I didn't really necessarily realize that that's what they were trying to do with their little one page entry point for the search, where you just type one thing in and it pops up. But that's really what they're trying to do, is they're trying to harness every thought that's ever been captured in the world and making that accessible. So let's talk about how computers work and how Google works in general. So whenever you think about data, and that's what this is, it's stored data, you've got to realize that every piece of information, when you type something down on your keyboard and you save that information on, let's just say, a Word document, that is a file, and that file sits on your computer. And so what the World Wide Web does is it links all these different computers together so that I can have access to maybe, say, something that Stig wrote over in Denmark, or let's say Hari wrote something over in San Francisco and captured that on a Word document. Through the internet, I'm able to link to that file. And what a lot of people don't realize is that the internet works a lot like our mail system, our old-fashioned type up a letter, put it in the mailbox, and send it off. So let's say that Hari types up a Word document and he stores it on his computer in San Francisco, and I want to have access to that file through Dropbox, or he puts it on a web page or a web server or whatever, and I want to access that. So whenever he saves that document, it's saved on his computer at a particular IP address. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard IP address before. Okay, and what an IP address is it's no different than your physical address. So I have an address if somebody wants to send me a piece of mail or a box through the post office. And so that IP address is exactly like that mailing address. And so if I want to go get this file off of Hari's computer, if I know his IP address, I could access that particular file by going to his computer. And that's how all this is linked together. And so what Google does, and let's get back to our discussion on Google. What Google has done is it has mapped the entire world's computers where all this information is saved. Okay. And they've mapped it. They've indexed it so that they have this all saved on computers that they've had. It's basically like a backup, a copy of everything that's out there. And so they have these massive web servers. They have these massive supercomputers in these data centers around the world. And these computers are constantly looking at everything that's called crawling the web. They're crawling the web for all this information, and then they're making duplicate copies of this information on their computers in order to know what's out there in order to provide you the best search results. So how did Google really become and rise to the top as being one of the top search results in order to find this information? Because if you think about that problem of trying to point somebody to the information that you're seeking, that's a really hard and complex problem, as everybody's typing up all this different information all over the world. So how do you point them to the article that they're actually searching for? And how do you get it right almost every single time? And so how the founders of Google, which is Larry Page and Sergey Brin, did this is they thought about the problem from a different vantage point. Whenever search engines first came out, they were based off of keyword density. So if, let's say, I was looking for an article on tennis, okay, if the article had the word tennis in it 5,000 times, that search result would rise to the top, and that'd be the article that would be, you know, showed as the best result. Well, as many people caught on to this, they would hide the text in the document through the HTML, and they would just type tennis about 5 billion times, and then their article would naturally rise to the top. So that didn't work real well because you had really kind of bad content that was search engine optimized, and that's how it rose to the top. And so what the founders of Google did is they did it a little differently, and they said, let's treat this like it's a research paper. And whenever you write a research paper in academia, which both of these students were out at Stanford University and working on their doctorate whenever they founded Google, and they started off with a thing called PageRank, which was what Larry Page had called his first search engine. The way that they framed it is they said, you know, whenever you find a really good research paper, at the bottom of that research paper, it has all these works cited references to other documents, to other, you know, professionals that have written about this. And so they said, well, if everybody's constantly linking or showing that the maybe this article by this professor over in Harvard wrote the best article on tennis. Let's go back to that example. If everybody's referencing this one document, that document that's being referenced is probably the best result and shows the most authority. And so they took this idea of referencing at the bottom of the page to a different level, and they started treating that as the link to the other person's content is a clue as to what is the most important piece of information to be found. So Stig, go ahead, and I see you have a comment that you wanted to add.
Yeah, so what's really important to understand is that Google wants to do its best to mimic the behavior of a real-life person. And clearly the problem is, if you want to map the whole world, you can't have a person or hundreds of thousands of people doing that. That's simply impossible. So what they're doing is that they are adapting the algorithm to act the most like a human being. And one way to do that, as Preston is saying, is looking at how many people are referencing, what we also call backlinking. So how many people are backlinking and saying that this page is relevant or this site is relevant for what you are searching for.
A fantastic point on how their algorithm works there, Stig. So just a little background. So whenever Larry Page and Sergey Brin founded the company at Stanford, they were just starting off, and it was really a research project that they were doing. And so they were using the servers and the computers at Stanford whenever they were doing it. And they started getting so much traffic coming to their site because their results were populating such good quality results that the servers there at Stanford started getting overused. They started buying more computers, and it just kind of evolved into this massive monster of computing power. And I think that at that point, it says in the book that they kind of realized that they had something fairly huge, and so they ventured off. Hari, do you know how much, didn't Stanford get some of the equity of Google whenever they decided to, you know, move outside of the campus of Stanford and found their own business? I can't remember in the book, but I thought I remember hearing like 10% or something like that.
You're right, Preston, around that number. In fact, Stanford has a very good incubator program. A lot of companies in the Silicon Valley have come out of Stanford, including companies like Sun, Yahoo, and others. And Stanford professors are known to have industry connections. And also, many of them have founded their own companies as well.
Yeah. Well, even the book, the Peter Thiel book that we did, The Zero to One, and he was giving the lecture at Stanford. That's where the book all came from. So, yeah, it definitely seems like there's a lot of Stanford alumni out in the Silicon Valley. So, all right. So let me continue. So when we're talking about Google, a lot of people have the question, how in the world do they make any kind of money? You know, when you show up on their homepage, you see that it's just one input. There's no advertisements. There's no nothing. And for a lot of people, they're like, how is that a $1 billion company? How are they making billions of dollars? And so they have a couple different engines that produce their revenue. So I'm going to talk about the first one that was in the book, and that is AdWords. So the way AdWords work is, let's say that you have a business and you sell tennis rackets. I'm on a tennis kick today, so that's why I keep referencing tennis. So let's say you own a business and you want to sell tennis rackets. What you could do is you could open an account with AdWords, which is owned by Google, and you could say anybody who searches for buy tennis racket or tennis racket, or you list all these different keywords and you list them into your account. And you say, I'm willing to pay $1 for every person that clicks on my advertisement if Google places it wherever Google places it. And so you're in your bidding. So this isn't just like you have this one agreement with Google. There's other people that are bidding for those same keywords that are wanting to own the search result, which will populate as an advertisement after you initiate your search. It'll populate there in the first position, or it could populate on page 5, depending on where you're willing to pay and where the bids fall. But it's one big giant auction, and you're competing with other people that are wanting that same keyword. And so every time that somebody clicks on that link, or it depends on if you're running advertisements per 1,000 or million or whatever, then those are the two different options. You can pay by click, or you can pay per 1,000 advertisements. But every time that somebody clicks on that, Google makes money, and the person who conducted the advertisement gets their benefit is that you drove somebody to your website. So AdWords was a major shift in search, because as this started to develop, there was a lot of people that had concern over, well, is Google just providing me the search result based off of who's paying me the most money, or are they actually giving me the results that are showing me the best web page to land on? And so there was a lot of discussion in the book about that, and it obviously raises some concern over the conflict of interest that you might see by running something like that. So, Hari, I saw you had a point that you wanted to add here.
You brought up a good point, Piston. In fact, if you are wondering how Google makes money, you are not alone. You're in good company. In fact, in the book, the author talks about a point in the early days of Google when the founders, Larry and Sergey Brin, were not really interested in starting their own company, and rather wanted to sell it off and they approached many companies. In fact, most of them rejected their offer. And in the book, he talks about how the CEO of Excite, George Beall, rejected their offer to sell their technology, the search engine, for $700,000, because he didn't know how they would make money. He thought it's a clever project by two Stanford grads.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was hilarious at the beginning when they were talking in the book. They were talking about how they came up with this search engine, but everyone was like, I don't understand how you're ever going to make any kind of money on this. And now you look at their revenues and they're making $60 billion in revenue a year, whatever it is. It's just quite funny. So that was AdWords. So you're basically advertising off of keywords that you would want for your business to drive traffic to your site. Now, this is where I think Google really had some genius in how they were going to raise money. So let's say that you own a website. So Stig and I, we have a website. Hari, you have a website, and you want to run an advertisement on your website for maybe somebody else's business. Well, that's a lot of coordination for you. You know, if you had to first establish the coordination with the company that you would run the advertisement on, you have to get their permission. You got to, you know, set up the code in order to lead them to their site. The code is quite complex, because that person has to know that they actually came from your site. So there has to be code associated with that. And it's a very big process for a person to run an advertisement. Well, Google came out with this brilliant idea of, hey, let's be that source. Let's just give somebody a source of code. They take that little snippet of code, they drop it into their website, and we'll do the advertising for you. We'll know what that person's looking for what it is that they want to buy, why they're maybe on your site, and we'll run relevant ads on your site. And every time somebody clicks on it, you, as the owner of that website, is going to make money. And so this was called Google AdSense. And so it's just an amazing tool for anybody that owns a website. You can just go to Google, sign up for an account. They'll give you a little snippet of code. You drop it into your website and boom, advertisements start showing up. And every time somebody clicks on that advertisement, you start making money. Something that I found really interesting in the book was they had a big debate on how much Google should actually make from AdSense. Sergey Brin had the opinion that they needed to not take too much money from the website owner because they didn't want to introduce a lot of competition into this field. Instead, they wanted to own this field. They didn't want anybody else out there to be able to do it. And this is a common theme that we've seen with people like Sam Walton, Jeff Bezos, where their opinion is, let's not take too big of a margin here. Let's own the space. Let's just dominate this space. And that way, we'll never bring on competitors, because if there's large margins, competitors will flock to that type of line of business. And so just something very interesting for, you know, as I was reading in the book and saw that. So as we progress forward and we kind of look at how Google grew, one of the things that I found just totally fascinating was the size of these data centers that they were building all around the world in order to service all their different customers that were conducting searches. One of the things that Larry Page was just really big on, and they have some really quite funny examples in the book, is the speed and how fast he wanted these servers to, in order to produce results and to load onto people's computers. So much so that he'd have people come into his office and like bring up certain topics, and he would be able to say, hey, that happened in half a second or 0.6 seconds or something like that, where he was timing people, and people would go back and say they'd reload the page that they were showing him in the office. And sure enough, like he was down to like the 10th of a second on the on his estimation of how fast different pages were loading, and people were just like flabbergasted that he could predict and see that. That just showed people how important that aspect of the business was to him. And so building these big data centers, building these computers that could capture all this information and harvest all that information was just quite fascinating and very interesting to know. So Hari, you had a point that you wanted to add here.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
In a world where convenience often compromises security, many investors settle for solutions that do not fully meet the demands of Bitcoin security. That's where the Bitcoin Way comes in. Offering a personalized white glove service, they will guide you through every step of the way to achieve full self-custody, ensuring you adhere to the strictest self-custody standards. Their experienced team helps establish robust security practices that cover all aspects of self-custody, cybersecurity, and privacy. Their ultimate goal? To empower you to become fully sovereign. Beyond securing your Bitcoin, they also offer services such as inheritance planning, Plan B strategies, assisting in relocating to Bitcoin-friendly locations to further enhance your sovereignty, and much, much more. Take the first step to true financial independence. Visit thebitcoinway.com/TIP to schedule your free consultation call. Don't delay in securing your generational wealth the right way. Opt in for security over convenience, and protect your future. Your family line will thank you.
If you're a solopreneur, small business owner, or remote worker, then listen up, because you've got to hear about Industrious. As a remote worker myself, I'm telling you that Industrious delivers the best co-working space I have ever been to. Industrious has co-working locations in major cities across the US, UK, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and they provide a ton of benefits to their members. They have secure high-speed internet, daily breakfast and snacks, courteous on-site staff support, and my favorite part is the social events they host, which make it easy for me to connect with others who want to unplug from their work for a bit. I just recently visited their Kansas City office, and the people there were absolutely amazing, and the staff was incredibly helpful to help me get settled in and perform at my best. We Study Billionaires loves Industrious, and they were able to hook our listeners up with a free week of co-working to check it out, take a tour, and experience all of the amazing perks they have to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to redeem a free week of co-working when you take a tour. That's industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to get your first week entirely for free. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next-level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit-like driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, Preston. So one of the things that a lot of us underestimate is how much of technology and infrastructure is needed to serve these search results. You just see a blank page with Google logo on it and you think, hey, what's so complicated about it? In fact, it's not just the algorithms, but the infrastructure that supports it is huge. In fact, in the book, the author talks about Google having about 24 data centers in 2009. I'm sure it'll be much more now. And each one of them costing $1 billion. He has also a vivid description of one of those data centers, which is the size of two football fields and has about 200,000 square feet of space for servers and other infrastructure, and a four-storied, 18,000 probably square feet facility for the cooling tower. I mean, that's humongous.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found it really interesting too, all the different things that they were talking about. You know, to cool all these computers and all this processing power, they've got to, you know, cool it. And so they're talking about putting them up in Alaska to Antarctica to having them out on ships and running seawater over top of things in order to constantly cool them and doing it at a really cheap price. There, I know that there's a lot of data centers that are underground in order to, you know, help dissipate the heat. It's just amazing, the technology and stuff that's happening. Go ahead, Ahari. You had a second point.
Yeah, and one of the things that most of us underestimate is the energy consumed by these data centers. When we talk about stuff going online, we're not buying books anymore. We think we are doing good for the environment because we are consuming less energy. However, data shows that 1.2% of all the electricity consumed in the United States today is by the data centers. To put that in the context, it's more than 20 states in U.S. in terms of, you know, energy consumption. So we have to really think hard about the impact of these data centers on environment. And that's why energy efficiency for Google, not only from an economic, but even from an environment perspective, is very important.
Hey, one of the points I wanted to bring up was just this contrarianism that we've read about in so many of these other books. I mean, almost every book we read, it's talking about how the billionaire has this just drive to always question or counter whatever it is that the common knowledge is. And so Larry Page really kind of struck me as that person for Google, in that he is just constantly trying to think beyond what most people would expect or think is normal. One of the funniest things I found in the book, they were talking about how Larry Page and Sergey Brin went over to the UK and were having dinner with the royal family. And they brought out this, and this is really, really off topic, but it was so funny. I can't help but bring it up. And so when they were there having dinner with the royal family, they brought out what looked like a little shot of a sauce that they would put on top of their souffle that they had made for them. And so they were sitting there with the Queen of England and they're having this dinner. And so both Sergey Brin and Larry Page took this sauce, which they were supposed to pour over top of their souffle, and they just drank it and they just pounded it like it was a shot of tequila or something like that. And I guess the royal family kind of looked over at them like they were crazy. And they were like, you know, as politely as they could say, they were like, You were supposed to pour that over your food, over the souffle. You were not supposed to drink that, you know? And their response, Larry Page's response was, "Who says?" And I just, I found that absolutely hilarious to the point where it's like, who are you to tell me what I'm going to pour my stuff over? If I want to drink it, I can drink it, you know? It just shows you that's how these guys think. If somebody tells them it can't be done, they're going to do it, and they're going to do it without even question or thought. And I just found that story to be so funny.
Christian, that was a very interesting episode. In fact, I think throughout the book, the author has given a lot of instances which shows a complete ignorance of popular culture among both these founders. And one of the things that the author points to is their background. And he talks about the Montessori education and how that has shaped the thinking of these two founders, both Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And it's interesting because my son is now in a Montessori, and I'm getting to know firsthand the philosophy behind Montessori system and how they encourage children to think for themselves.
You know, that's a fantastic point. I think a lot of people might not even realize what that is. And so in our show notes, we'll have a good write-up of what Hari's referring to, and something else that Sergey had gone through with his education as a young kid. And just so everyone knows, Sergey Brin was 19 years old when he was at Stanford working on his doctorate when he founded Google. So just to kind of give you an idea of what we're dealing with here as far as intellect with some of these people. Go ahead, Stig, you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, there was just another funny story, just to say something about the character. Because he was asked by his dad, like, shouldn't you take any advanced courses, you know, to improve your your knowledge? And he was like, yeah, I'm considering advanced swimming. The end.
All that father-son relationship. It's prevalent in every person's family. All right. So let me just conclude this first segment. So the last thing that I wanted to talk about is just the analytics. So Google's at the point where they have all of this information. They've basically mapped the brain of the world, if you want to refer to it as that. And whenever you do something like that, you see the traffic patterns, you see where people are going, you know how long they sit on a site, you know how often they go to a site, you know exactly what they're searching for, to the point where you go onto Google today and you start typing something, you might only have three letters typed into the search box and it already knows what you're looking for. And so that's advantageous for a business because they can identify the next YouTube because they can see the traffic patterns. They can identify the next Google Earth because they can see the traffic patterns. And so whenever you're in that position of really knowing and having just information is what it is, just the flow of information, you are you're in a completely different realm than any other business out there. And so if they're able to continue to manage this and to continue to grow this business and manage their finances, because that's where they could potentially get themselves in trouble if their margins ever started to dissipate. But as long as they continue to track that flow of information and the analytics, I find them to be a very dangerous business moving forward. And I mean dangerous in a good way in their ability to grow and just be one of those top tier businesses for decades to come.
I was really impressed by how data driven Google is. And clearly no one's probably surprised when I say it's data driven. But after reading this book, I'm just so, so impressed how they use it. So for instance, when talking about analytics, one of the founders said, the more people know, the more people will buy. That was one of his key arguments to actually establishing Google Analytics. And Google also internally, they use this data to so many things. At one point in time in the book, it says that we don't have to argue. No one has to argue at our meetings. We just need to look at the data. And I thought that was just a good analogy to see the business model that Google has put together.
Oh, yeah. I think for marketing departments around the world, it's flipped everything upside down because marketing used to just be so qualitative. Well, I think that this advertisement's going to do well. And there was really no way to track the progress of how that actually worked. But with Google Analytics and AdWords and AdSense and all these other things that they got, it's pretty obvious what the truth is and how something actually works. So let's quickly talk about the Google culture, and I want to bring Hari into the mix because I know Hari works right in that area when he's there at LinkedIn. They're building surround the Google the Googleplex, if you will. And he's had lunch over there, eating in some of their buildings. And just so everyone knows, Google is really well known for how they treat their employees. Unlike Amazon with the Jeff Bezos model, which they don't really treat their employees all that well, Google's at the exact opposite. So let me just give you an example. So Google will do their employees' laundry for them. They will have cars there. So if people want to just drive around in company cars, they can drive around in company cars. They have gourmet chefs that cook for people at no cost. You don't have to pay for your lunch. You don't have to pay for your dinner. There's a bunch of Google perks. So Hari, can you give us some of the Google perks that you've actually seen firsthand?
Sure, Kristen. You're right. In fact, I feel Google's employees are really spoiled. they probably will find it hard to work anywhere else. I mean, the kind of perks they get is unheard of. And Google, in a way, is setting the bar for other companies in the Valley, whether it is Facebook, LinkedIn, or any other company, because they have to compete for the top talent. And Google has been striving ever since the founding of the company to have a different contrarian culture. In fact, in the book, the author talks about how both the founders never liked working when they interned in any other company because they just didn't like the culture. And they wanted to kind of, you know, maintain that university or college dorm kind of an atmosphere in the company even when they got big. And they have been striving to do that. And when I read this book, it was very interesting because I have visited those cafes that the author talks about. And the author, Stephen Levy, has done a very good job in describing the culture, the facilities, as well as the vibe that you get when you enter the Google campus. As the company has grown, however, some amount of bureaucracy has crept in. And a lot of talented engineers have left Google to either start their own companies or to other competitors like Facebook, as they have found challenges and interesting opportunities elsewhere. Having said that, Google still is among the top destination for many smart engineers, not just engineers in the Valley, but around the United States and around the world.
So, you know, this is where I think we can transition into the second segment really well, because as we talk about all these perks and all these cultural things that Google has for their employees, you really have to ask yourself, is that adding real value whenever you're looking at the company? And I think one of the things that immediately strikes me is this culture and whether this culture is even sustainable. I think today it's easily sustainable just because the company has such large margins. You know, whenever you look at the fact that they're, when you look at their top line to their bottom line, there's a 21.5% margin there, which is absolutely huge. And this is on their income statement. So every dollar that they bring in, they're effectively keeping 21 cents of it, which that's very high. I think for most businesses around the United States, if you're making 10%, you're doing really well. So for them to be bringing in over 20% is a very high margin, and that's how they can get away with sustaining this type of culture. But my concern would be as they move 5-10 years into the future, as maybe more competition comes into this marketplace, how are they going to sustain that competitive advantage, and how are they going to keep those margins in place in order to pay for the $70 million worth of perks that they give their employees every single year? So that's a concern that I have if I was going to own this company moving forward. The one thing that I will tell you that I do like is the brand. I think that a lot of people inherently just go on the internet and immediately search or bring up Google without any second thought entering their mind. And I think that that's a huge burden for any competitor to overcome. And I think that that's going to be definitely a strength in owning this as their brand. I also think that their proprietary software is of enormous value. I think that their search results are better than other people, and that's going to be something that's going to be also very difficult to overcome. And I think that they're only going to get better as time marches on, too, and as they continue to develop and fine-tune that software. I obviously like the margins, but I just don't know how long we can sustain them. So this the point that I have as a negative is also kind of a positive in the fact that I definitely think that their margins, it's going to allow them to continue to grow over time a lot faster than, say, any other type of business. So the one concern that I have, and this is kind of a love-hate relationship that I have with the leadership, I think that Larry Page is absolutely brilliant. I think that Sergey Brin is brilliant. My only concern is that they're kind of like this rich kid who's been spoiled from the start of their life or from the start of their business's life, and that reality has never really set in for them to really go through some very difficult times with the amount of money that they bring in versus the profit that they make. And I'd be really interested to see how they'd be able to handle that if they did come across hard times and they weren't as profitable as they are, and how they would manage that with their business and this culture that they've bred. I think that that's going to be a very tough transition if it ever occurs, which I think it will. So then the last thing is obviously the price for me. And so whenever I look at this, just generically, without getting into discount cash flow models or anything like that, the PE on this company is close to 30. That's very high. That's definitely a premium to be paying for a company that with 20% margins. I'm not owning it right now, and I'm not buying it anytime soon. But if the market would offer an opportunity, I would be a buyer. So that's kind of where I stand. Stig, let's hear your thoughts.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
I don't own Google and I don't intend to. And it's really not because it's a bad stock. Preston talked about the price and it's probably overvalued, but it's clearly a very good company in terms of profitability and growth. One thing I do like about Google is that they have been able to apply all the profits that the company has made the last 10, 15 years. And they have been able to do that while sustaining their margins. And that's actually very hard to do when you're growing as much as Google has. If you take a closer look at the financial statements for Google, you also start to see that the company is slowing down. And I wouldn't say I'm concerned about that. I would actually say it's quite natural for most company at that size. They really can't keep growing at that pace. Again, if you compare it to a company like Amazon, which we discussed a few episodes ago, and they actually have less revenue than Amazon has, but again, they are making very decent margins. So it's just to give you something to compare with in terms of size. I think that Google has a very wide moat, especially if you compare it to other companies in the sector. I think it's very hard with all the intangible assets to go in and start making AdWords or start making search. that requires such heavy capital expenditures that it's very, very hard to enter. With that said, when you think about how Google started, and then there's a lot in the book, there's a lot of comparison to Microsoft. I'm sure you would have said the same thing to Google like 15 or 20 years ago. How can you ever compete with Microsoft? You don't have the same amount of cash that they're having. You don't have the same engineers. How is that possible? And I think that Preston had a good point before. If things start to turn sour, how will they respond to that? When a new competitor comes, is Google really fast enough to adapt to the new changes? As Harry was saying before, the company too bureaucratic at the moment, and will it just continue to get worse as they grow? That would probably be my main concern.
All right, Hari, let's hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Stig, you brought up a very good point about what people said about Microsoft back in the days when Microsoft was at the top of its game and out of nowhere came Google. And I was thinking about it. It's already starting to happen to Google when Facebook started gaining prominence in the social area. And as we all know, Google has been struggling to gain a footing in the social space, but it's not in its DNA. In fact, in an interview, Larry Page described Google as an artificial intelligence company that collects massive amounts of data and then uses the data through its algorithms to augment the collective brain of the humanity. That's their core value or core competence. But when they strayed out of their core competence and started chasing Facebook, which the author also talks about in the book, they were seen as an ugly duckling. And they came up with many products like Google Buzz, Orkut, Wave, and now Google Plus, which is known as the geekier version of Facebook. They never actually succeeded, or they never were seen as the top player in the social networking area. Having said that, after observing Google for many years, one of the things that I have understood is if I want to value Google, I should think like a venture capitalist and not like a value investor. Let me explain. If you try to value Google, Amazon, or Facebook in a traditional sense, that is, if you're considering revenues, earnings, free cash flow, debt, margins, you're missing the big picture. These are companies with innovation in their culture, and they have less regard for revenues and profits than most other mature companies that we see in the market. In fact, in many ways, Amazon and Google have a lot of similarities in their operating philosophies. Both companies have an obsessive focus on customers and user experience. They're not afraid of risks and experimenting with new ideas and are extremely data-driven, as you mentioned, Stig. They encourage innovation from bottoms up, that is, from their employees or engineers. And at times, this might seem chaotic or disorganized or even inefficient in terms of use of capital. And both have these visionary, highly ambitious leader. But if you look at these companies, they are more like a VC or a venture capital firm with a strong operating business generating cash, which they invest in R&D and developing their own new products. Some of them will succeed, some of them will fail. And also by acquiring new companies. But they make risky bets. In fact, when they bought YouTube, Android, or the maker of AdSense, there was no revenue in some cases and no profits at all. But after many years, they have made a huge impact on the bottom line for Google. So if I'm trying to value Google, it's very hard because I don't know what's next. Will they lose money in their many bets and a lot of spending? Or will there be a hidden black swan in a positive way? You know, like there might be the next YouTube in their laps. So I do believe, as Christian mentioned, the law of large numbers will eventually catch up with Google at some point, sooner or later. And there is also a risk that the founders can be overconfident and there can be a different sort of a group think, you know, like being contrarian is a group think at Google, and the author has captured that very well. You know, if you talk about profits, if you talk about earnings, you are kind of, you know, kicked out of the room. All you have to talk about is changing the world. And one of the things that is interesting about Google is even now 90% or more of their revenue comes from their ads business, which is mostly search and their publisher network. None of their other initiatives has made a dent in their overall revenue or business model yet. So what I would like to say is, if you're valuing Google, you have to think like Peter Thiel. And more importantly for me, I have to know whether it is in the circle of my competence. Can I really understand how Google works, how it innovates, and what are the probabilities? If I don't, I would stay away. And in fact, I'm going to stay away from Google for now, though I admire that company.
Wow, I was totally thinking that you were going to say that you own some. Okay, go ahead, Stig.
Yeah, because, you know, I think the way to look at Google, especially if you're pessimistic or if it's outside of your circle of competence, which, you know, in my belief, the only one I know that would be within their circle of competence in this matter would probably be Hari. but Google is definitely outside my circle of competences. And again, the way to look at that might be to look at Microsoft like 15 years ago, because everybody was looking at Microsoft and saying, it's impossible to compete with Microsoft because they have the one and only operating system that everyone uses, and they have Microsoft Office. So how can we ever compete with that? And what Google did was they were just looking, you know, at the business completely different. So they started to think about web applications. And if you look something at Google Chrome today, you almost have an operating system within your browser. So that was just a totally different way of competing with Microsoft, where Microsoft couldn't keep up. And then, Harry, you said something about social media, where Google Plus is really, you said it was like the geeky little brother or something to Facebook, but it's definitely not working as good as Facebook or LinkedIn or some of those companies. And the thing is that, yes, it might be true that no one is able to compete with Google ever in terms of search and AdWords, but no one knows if that is where the war is to be fought in 10 or 15 years. In 10 years, we will probably use something different than social media, at least in another form. And there's a good chance that Google won't be there to pick it up. They got lucky, and or they were good at picking YouTube up. They didn't pick up Facebook or LinkedIn. Who's to know when the next wave is coming if they can make money in that business?
This was really fun, guys. This is awesome. I definitely think very highly of Google. I think the business is just an amazing business to kind of look at, and it's definitely different than almost everything else out there. I'm very curious to see the direction that it goes in the future. I'm also very interested to see how IBM competes with Google as they go into these big data analytics moving forward. IBM is a company that I have money in, and I'm assuming that Stig and Hari are the same, correct? Yeah, Hari's saying yes. Stig, how about you? Do you have anything in mind? Stig does not have anything in IBM. But so it's kind of interested. I'm very interested to see how kind of things progress as we move forward. The book by Stephen Levy was fantastic. A very good book. Not as business oriented as the Everything Store that we read about Jeff Bezos. But if you're really kind of trying to understand how Google works, maybe you have an online business or something like that, I think it'd be a very useful tool for you to kind of do more research on. So we highly recommend the book. We have our show notes as usual. If you want to get the show notes, make sure that you sign up for those show notes on our mailing list, which is on our website. And before we sign off, we're going to go ahead and play our question from Derek Randell. He recorded his question on asktheinvestors.com. And if you want to get your question played, make sure you go there and record your question for us.
Hi, Preston and Stig. How are you? This is Derek from Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. Thank you so much for all your work on the Investors Podcast, as well as your Buffett Books website. I've been learning a ton, so thank you very much. My question is in relation to opportunity cost. In episode 9, you reviewed the book by Charles Koch and introduced the term opportunity cost. My question is, how do you actually calculate the opportunity cost between two stocks when future returns are unknown? Anyway, thank you very much, and I hope you can answer this question.
So, Derek, this is one of my favorite topics, is opportunity cost. And one of the things that we did on the Buffett's Books website is we built a sell calculator for whenever you want to sell stocks. We could actually call that an opportunity cost calculator if we wanted to do that as well. We'll have a link to that in our show notes to take you to the Buffett's Book sell calculator, which I should probably rename that. And I think I will after I'm done recording this, to sell/opportunity cost calculator. But what you're able to do with that is you're coming up with an estimate of what the cash flows might look like for any particular stock. So let's say that we have stock A and we think that the cash flows might be $100 over the next 10 years. And then we have another stock, which we'll call stock B. And let's say that we think that the cash flows might be $200 over the next 10 years. Okay. And what we do is we discount both of those cash flows back to today's present value, and we come up with what we think the market price should be. Then we compare and we look at what the market price actually is, and then that'll give you a return. So let's say with stock A, we thought the return might be 10%, and with stock B, it might be 12% based off of the actual price that it's trading for. And so whenever you're looking at those, that difference or that delta between the two, it's a 2% difference. So what you have to ask yourself is, if you own stock A or you already own stock B, what is it going to cost after you pay capital gains to get out of that particular pick and move it into the other pick? And that's opportunity cost at its best. So I would highly recommend that you go there, learn how to use that calculator. It kind of works in conjunction with our intrinsic value calculator, so you're going to really need to know how to use both. But if you have any other questions on this, feel free to send us another message, or we can maybe describe it better on another show, or even kind of build a page that describes how the two are worked together so it's more clear for people. But this is the most important thing you can really understand in stock investing, because stock investing is all relative. It is all relative. The value of one thing is relative to the value of another thing. So you've got to really thoroughly understand opportunity cost. And this calculator, I personally use it all the time. So you could say that I eat my own cooking. But this is something that I would definitely go check out. Watch the video on it and watch the video on the intrinsic value. And I think you'll have a much better idea of what it is that we are talking about. All right, so that concludes our show. We really appreciate everybody joining us. We'd like everybody to go to Hari's website, bitsbusiness.com. We really appreciate him joining us. He's pretty much a staple here on the show. Anytime we read a good book or need to have a great discussion, we always bring Hari onto the show. So thanks for joining us, Hari. And we'll see everybody next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application. TIP!